This is The Point on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, April 19th. This is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Eve Zukoff. We'll speak with Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. We'll check in with Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. CAI's Patrick Flannery speaks with our State House correspondent Katie Lannon, and we'll hear from Grace Ferguson of the New Bedford Light. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. Massachusetts is getting a new climate change leader. Allison Brizius is taking over the Division of Coastal Zone Management, which directs flood prevention and habitat protection, storm mitigation, and much more. CAI's environment reporter Eve Zukoff caught up with her in an exclusive interview. Eve joins us now. Hi.
Hey.
Tell us about Allison Brizius. Who is she? How did she end up in this role?
Yeah, so she is the former commissioner of the Environment Department in the city of Boston. There, she was responsible for helping the city reach the big goal of achieving net zero emissions, all while protecting air, water, land resources, enhancing environmental justice. And before that, she kind of has this background I'll go through quickly. She was the city's director of climate and environmental planning. Before that, she was in kind of the more private sector as executive director of the Center for Robust Decision Making on Climate and Energy Policy at UChicago, and she received her PhD in physics from the University of Chicago. So she really has been spending a career kind of preparing for this role.
So what will she be doing in leading the Office of Coastal Zone Management?
Well, generally, the office's mission is to balance the impact of human activities with the protection of coastal and marine resources. That all needs to happen through planning, public outreach, education, research, resource management. And she's got a lot of work to do. There are about 2.5 million people living within the 78 coastal communities in Massachusetts. The majority of people in those communities are low income, people of color, people facing language barriers, about 55%. And Massachusetts is planning and preparing for some major climate change impacts. You know, we should expect sea level rise to go up by about sea levels to go up by about 2.5 feet by mid-century compared to just 2008 if global carbon emissions aren't seriously reduced. Also, by 2070, the state estimates that damages to coastal structures, we're talking homes, businesses, you know, also all the infrastructure just along our shores, could exceed $1 billion a year if global warming isn't slowed. So one thing she told me, every dollar invested in disaster mitigation pays back six times over in avoided losses. And she is going to help us figure out where to put those dollars to maximize the benefits.
Well, around our region, we see impacts of global warming already with increasing storms and stronger storms and higher high tides that are flooding downtown sometimes. What are some of the projects that in particular are going to be coming out of her office that you'll be watching?
Yeah, well, the Healy Driscoll administration launched the Resilient Coasts Initiative earlier this year, and they described it as a holistic and proactive strategy to guide state and local resiliency policy and action. It's been pretty short on details. We don't really know what that means and how it unites our communities and helps them be more resilient. Brizius, when she starts on May 6th, will oversee this initiative, and then also she'll be implementing the state's coastal programs, ensuring environmental justice and equity is embedded into the work. I'm really looking forward to seeing what this Resilient Coasts Initiative actually looks like on the ground, how it helps our communities. And of course, I'm looking forward to seeing her get to know our region. She's coming from Boston, totally different human ecosystem and physical ecosystem out there. She says she has a lot to learn about the Cape Coast and Islands.
She talked some about collaboration, too, in terms of how this process is going to work forward. And you think about the towns on the ground dealing with these issues, and now she's coming in from the state side trying to understand how to help towns.
Yeah, and I think that the biggest way that the state can help towns is through funding. You know, when states say, like, this is, you know, in Falmouth, Surf Drive is a road that needs protection, we could really use some help funding that protection. Or downtown Chatham, as you said, downtown Nantucket. Like, these are areas where locals probably know best, and the states can probably best assist with funding or some kind of innovative policies. But that's where it gets a little bit more controversial often.
Let's switch gears right now and talk about another story you covered this week. Students at all seven public schools in Falmouth will be composting by the end of this school year. Tell us how this came about and what it really means.
Well, school officials launched initially a pilot program with Mullen Hall and Morse Pond in Falmouth to see if students would really jive with composting. And then this month, three schools, Lawrence, Falmouth High School, and T-Ticket, will begin composting in honor of Earth Day on April 22nd. That's on Monday. And then the remaining two schools in North and East Falmouth will begin in May. And at that point, the entire district will be composting. To be clear, there are other school districts across the Cape where there are schools that are composting, but this is the only school I have been able to find that is doing a district-wide composting that involves all the students in the lunchroom. And school officials told me they're really excited because a lot of the time they tell kids that climate change is happening and it's this big, scary thing. But this is something that the kids can do every day that makes a difference.
You said there's a pilot program already running. What do the early reports look like?
They look really good. And to be clear, there's help. So staff and volunteers stand in the lunchroom, especially at the beginning, behind compost bins to show them what goes where. There are also posters above the bins that help explain that they need to separate their chicken bones and their apple cores and their sandwich bread and lettuce, whatever, and also the stickers that come on fruit and vegetables. But at the pilot schools, this has really worked. I talked with Superintendent Lori Durr, and she said she was encouraged to see how quickly students adapted. Once she talked to these kindergartners and said, like, can you teach me how to compost? I've never composted before, although she assured me she had. They were so happy to, like, tell the superintendent how to take her tray up and separate her, silverware from everything else on her plate.
So nice idea. Do we have an idea of how effective the program is?
We do. This year at Lawrence and Mullen Hall alone, these pilot schools, I was told that they prevented 26 tons worth of food waste from ending up in the trash stream, and that adds up to about 17 metric tons of carbon emissions that are avoided. Because composting is amazing. It turns our scraps into soil that is fertile and beautiful for more planting. And again, there are more schools across the region that are doing this work, but it's really interesting to see if Falmouth will set a precedent for other districts to do a district-wide approach to composting.
Okay, before you go, as our climate and environment reporter, I want to mention that Earth Day is next week. It's Earth Day, but it's really Earth Day week all through the week. What can people expect on our air to mark that?
Stories all week. And actually, there's a theme that people should expect from us next week. Every single day, we'll be doing stories about climate change and housing, how climate change affects unhoused people, the struggle to afford flood insurance, how renters can lower fossil fuels in their homes, and so much more. These stories will be coming from us and reporters based at NPR affiliate stations around New England through the New England News Collaborative, our wonderful partners. And the hope is that we are talking to people about how the homes we live in can help us fight climate change.
And it's Right Whale Day in the middle of next week, too.
Which exactly.
Is a state, I think it's just the second Right Whale Day now.
I believe that's right, because I think we covered last year's as the first. And we will have some news on that next week as well.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. Eve, thank you.
Thank you.
A driver on Martha's Vineyard being chased by police raced his truck through security gates at the Oak Bluffs ferry terminal and drove headlong off the pier. Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times joins us with this story and more. Hi, Unki.
Hello, Steve.
This story starts last Thursday night, but it's kind of continued through the week. Take us back to this car chase. Explain what we know about how this unfolded.
So this started... It started last Thursday when a police officer in Oak Bluffs noticed a truck in town at night, and he recognized it as belonging to an individual who was kind of wanted for alleged domestic violence from earlier in the same night. So he tried to get the guy to stop. The driver eventually stopped before ramming into the police cruiser and speeding off. And there was a chase following that. And, well, we kind of know what happens. He drove straight, crashing through the gates of the Steamship Authority's padlocked areas where they keep vehicles from going during the off-season, straight into the water. And the guy got out of his truck. He was able to get under the pilings, only had some minor injuries, and he was later taken to Deuce County Jail.
There, on your website, you've got, I think, a couple of different footage feeds from this incident where the truck goes crashing through the gates and then goes off the end of the dock. And actually, before we get that to that, let me ask you about the police officer who was in the car that was hit by this truck. What do we know about what happened to the vehicle and the officer?
Well, fortunately, the officer is Sergeant Chris Wiggin, and fortunately, he wasn't injured during the incident, but the cruiser itself was damaged pretty badly from a photo that the Opelousas Police Department really, you can see the front of the car, just kind of, there's a big dent in it and whatnot. The police label on it is crooked. So that thing is a little busted.
Mm. Bring us up to speed now on where this story is, because part of this was after the truck went off the end of the pier. It was in the water for a number of days, and obviously the ferry company trying to figure out, they have to pull it out and deal with it.
That's right. The truck had to stay in the water for a few days because of there was some bad weather over the weekend, but they also had to bring a crane over to actually, get the vehicle out. And that took place on April 16th. So that's Tuesday, this past Tuesday. And yeah, that's in a scrapyard right now, just kind of waiting for the owner, in a sense, because he was arraigned last Friday, and he was held on bail.
Mm. And his case is moving forward now. As you say, the police were already responding to a report of a domestic incident that sort of precipitated all of this. So all of that is being both that and the chase that came afterwards is kind of unfolding right now in court. He's being held on bail, you say?
Yes, he is. And yeah, they're both things are going through the court. Police haven't really released certain details because it is a domestic case, and those are very sensitive. But there's other things they did release a bit more readily, such as ramming into that vehicle, and other charges. His attorney is like, the court is kind of trying to figure out a bit more on like his mental health and whatnot, because, well, there were no drugs or alcohol involved in this incident, and, well, to be frank, not many folks will drive right off a pier in their truck. So, yeah, it's still going. And his next court day is scheduled for next month.
Okay, let me ask you about another story that you reported this week, and this is about the proliferation of submerged power cables that will likely be running past the vineyard with the growing offshore wind industry. First, can you explain what these cables are doing?
So these cables connect between where the offshore wind turbines are and where they make landfall on the mainland to connect with our power grid. So, such as Vineyard Wind, a lot of people notice the turbine because now they're up there. But the cable, it makes land, it kind of goes up from where it is in the ocean to Barnstable.
So these can be like 30-mile long cables or very long cables, because these offshore wind facilities are anywhere from 15 to 30 miles offshore, and the power they're generating has to make land somewhere. It's almost like a giant extension cord lying on the bottom of the ocean. There's concerns about how many of these are going to be running by the vineyard or how they're going to be laid out. Tell us a little bit about what people are looking at.
Yeah, we talked to some folks, including some commercial folks in the commercial fishing industry, and there are some concerns about just how many that there will be in the area, just because we haven't had this many cables before. We did also talk to some folks, like such as from the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, and some offshore wind developers like Avangrid and Ørsted. They say that it's not really a concern. The electromagnetic fields that will be emanating from cables they don't expect them to be a big concern in terms of impact to such local species and whatnot, but it's still something that folks are keeping an eye on in case, say, something that's sensitive to that type of thing does change its behavior and whatnot.
And these wind companies that are laying the cables, they're in communication with the stakeholders here, people like fishing industry or the Martha's Vineyard coastal communities?
Yes, too, but it's also, we have to point out, is there are a lot, these are all very much separate projects. Some of them are owned or involved by single companies, like Avangrid has three of them, and around the area, one's Vineyard Wind, others two, another one on the way or planned. Ørsted has a bunch of them, and there's a few more companies involved. So how each company handles things is a little different. The ones that we spoke to did say that they have been involved in talking with the coastal communities and with commercial fishermen. Someone we talked to was the president of the Martha's Vineyard Fishermen's Preservation Trust, Jonathan. He gave credit to Vineyard Wind for, you know, actually being pretty proactive in with the commercial fishing community, although he says some companies haven't been as, you know, forthcoming in trying to make efforts.
It's Unki Sunu with the Martha's Vineyard Times, where you can find both articles detailing the stories. Unki, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to take a quick break now. When we come back, we'll check in with Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Stay with us. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. The street drug fentanyl is back in the spotlight after the arrest of an alleged fentanyl trafficker in West Chatham and the apparent overdose death of a woman in the same house. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us with more on this. Hi, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, your reporter Alan Pollock does a great job explaining the prevalence of this drug, which many people may not be aware of, and what its impact has been. Explain what the drug is and just how widespread its use is.
So fentanyl is a synthetic opioid. It's been around now for more than a decade, and it's been on Cape Cod since around 2012. And it's been responsible for literally thousands of deaths in the United States and many on the Cape and Islands during that time as well. It's something like 50 to 100 times more potent than heroin and other opioids, and it's gotten so much into the community, and it's so addictive that authorities told us that it's really overtaken heroin as sort of the drug of choice on the streets.
And it's so deadly. Talk a little bit about that and why it seems to be, surpassing anything else that's out there in that way.
Yeah, it's what fentanyl does is it causes a respiratory distress, and that can stop the heart. And the way it does it makes it more difficult to reverse that situation than say a traditional heart attack. It's harder to get the heart started again, and it doesn't respond as well as something like heroin does to, Narcan, the drug that can reverse an overdose. And often they're finding now that that fentanyl is being mixed with not just heroin but other things like horse tranquilizers and things that either disguise it so people don't know that they're taking it, which they may take what they think is a normal dose of another drug, heroin or something, and if it's got fentanyl in it, then it's so much more potent and it can be so much more dangerous at that point.
Mm. One of the things that Alan Pollack, your reporter, does here is kind of look at how it's really affecting people's lives on the Cape, and talk a little bit about that, how we're seeing that in the community.
Well, what we're seeing is people who get involved in this drug, you know, it's kind of like the, you know, the old standard that you hear about people who fall into drug addiction. And because the fentanyl is so easy to get and it can be pretty expensive, people, they fall into the situation where, you know, they try a little bit, then they need more. And, you know, eventually their relationships are affected and their jobs. And really, you know, the authorities tell us that, you know, there's not much they could do until there's some sort of crime involved, because being an addict is not illegal, as Deputy Chief of Police in Chatham, Lou Malzone, told us. And the police then are trying, they really try to get people help rather than arrest them when they're in these positions.
Talk a little bit about that, too, the public health initiative here that's going on around it.
Sure. Yeah, there's a number of initiatives going on. The Outer Cape Health Services, which has a location in Harwich and Wellfleet, and I think Provincetown, they've got a structured outpatient addiction program, which they offer to people to help wean people off these drugs. Local communities have also benefited from the opioid, the federal opioid class action settlement. For instance, in Chatham, over the course of a number of years, Chatham will get over $300,000. So far, $87,000 has come the town's way, and that's been used to work with the Fishing Partnership on a Narcan program, and also to institute a preventative program in the Monomoy schools, and also the local health services have hired a recovery coach that works in the town one day a week, and this is shared in other towns too, where people can meet with this person and get the help they need.
I want to ask you about another story this week, a more upbeat story. A couple of public sculptures coming to Orleans. One of them is going up in the center of a busy roundabout. It's going to be quite a significant addition to the townscape, it sounds like. Tell us about this.
Yeah, definitely. This sculpture is called Wind Dance. It's a 13-foot tall steel sculpture by Chatham artist Tom O'Dell. And this is going to go right in the middle of a new roundabout at Route 28 and 39. It's the roundabout has just been completed, and the sculpture is due to be installed next week. And it's part of a long effort by the Orleans Improvement Association to put this some kind of public art in the middle of the roundabout. They didn't really want to put plantings in it because they were worried that the people who would have to take care of the plantings, you know, they have to cross the busy roadway to do so. And we're told that this is actually the first public arts in a roundabout on a state road. So it's kind of a big deal for the town and the state. There's a second public art sculpture that's going to be installed in Orleans next week. And this is a smaller sculpture that'll go at the corner of Brewster Cross Road and Main Street. And this one's sponsored by the Orleans Cultural District. So there's a lot of art going on in Orleans, which is really cool. The cultural district has a map that has locations of 14 different public art pieces right around the downtown area. It's a lot of people don't realize that there's that much public art in Orleans, but they have this map, and it's about a 30-minute walk, and you can visit all these different sculptures and public art pieces.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, where you can find a picture of the new sculpture that's going to be going up there at the intersection of Route 28 and 39. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Steve.
Is the State Department steering some J-1 summer workers away from Provincetown? This is a developing story. Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent joins us to explain what we know about it. Hi, Ed.
Good morning, Steve.
Ed, these are international college students who typically come in the summer to work here, and many of them return to the same business year after year. But this year, some unusual reports have come up.
Yes. This is a really strange story, really. Nothing like this has ever happened, as far as we've been able to find. As you say, these summer college student workers under the State Department's J-1 Summer Work Travel Program, they get sponsored by local employers. We heard from Frank Vasello, who runs a sandwich shop in the west end of Provincetown called Relish, that three of the six Bulgarian students that he was sponsoring this summer have been told by the State Department that they should find a job in some other town. That all three of these received emails from the U.S. Embassy in Sofia, Bulgaria, saying they should find a different employer, quote, preferably in a city other than Provincetown. And we found that there were five other businesses in town whose J-1 students were told the same thing. But at the same time, a number of other businesses' workers were approved without any incident.
Give us a sense of how important J-1 workers are to businesses in Provincetown and across the Cape each summer.
This is huge, really. Last summer, there were 351 J-1 students working in Provincetown alone. Before COVID disrupted international travel, in 2019, there were about 500 in Provincetown, 700 in the four outer Cape towns together, and about 5,000 altogether on Cape Cod. This is really a big deal for Provincetown, which has a tremendous need for summer workers. In fact, town manager Alex Morse, when he heard about this, said he was deeply concerned and immediately contacted the office of our Congressman Bill Keating, whose staff member said that Keating had immediately requested a briefing from the State Department. We're waiting to hear what the outcome of that might be. It's such an unusual situation. Some of the people that we talked to about it thought that it could be a scam. The emails seemed so strange and random. But others felt that it was probably related to something that happened last year regarding pedicab drivers.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I remember we talked about this last year on the roundup when this happened. But this was an incident in which a number of J-1 workers were quite a number were being examined for whether they were working in the pedicab businesses. And some of them were even pulled and sent home.
Yes, five of last summer's J-1 students were actually sent back home to Bulgaria for driving pedicabs. It turns out that pedicab driving is specifically prohibited in the J-1 program rules.
And for people who don't know, pedicabs are bicycle taxi kind of vehicles, right? They're pedaled like a bicycle, and there's a back seat where people can sit.
Yes, exactly. They're like little chariots. And they're very popular in Provincetown, and they're very popular with the foreign student workers because they make good money, and it's a good way for them to interact with local people. So they love the work. Somebody, we don't know who, tipped off at least one of the agencies that helps to arrange for these J-1 visas. And someone came last summer, did some investigating, and there was a crackdown. It seems as if the State Department was certainly very aware of this and concerned about it. Frank Vasello, the Relish sandwich shop owner, said that two State Department officials had visited him last summer to ask him questions about whether his workers were also driving pedicabs.
There was a kind of a, I'm not sure even how to describe it, like a small wrinkle in the rules that said that J-1 workers can't drive pedicabs. And even people who've been working with J-1 workers for a long time weren't aware, some of them, of this one stipulation.
Well, apparently not. The town officials all told us that they didn't know about this rule, although apparently the sponsoring agencies that the students come through did know about them. So it's a little bit of a gray area there, and we're still trying to get some kind of guidance from the State Department about why this is happening. And we did call our reporter, Sam Pollock, called up the U.S. Embassy in Sofia, Bulgaria, but they wouldn't talk to him about it. At the State Department in Washington, they just answered questions with generalities and wouldn't talk about the specifics of this particular situation.
And the summer season for a lot of these businesses is starting up soon. They're trying to line up their workers right now.
Well, yeah, they're sort of panicking because it is starting soon, and it's a really big deal to line up workers for Provincetown, especially where it's so hard to get places for people to live. And if they don't know whether their wet workers are going to be able to come or not, they're really stuck.
It's Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent. Ed, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We are going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. Nantucket Springtown Meeting is coming up, and town officials have proposed about $42 million in capital spending. Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror joins us with the details behind that big number. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
There are a lot of numbers here in the story. Tell us, what are some of the items being proposed in this $42 million of capital spending?
Sure. There's quite a laundry list of projects that town would like to see accomplished in the coming year or two. They include proposals to increase landfill capacity, rebuild the Jetties Beach tennis courts, design a new public works facility, pay about $2 million for a new fire department ladder truck, among a bunch of other projects. If all this spending is approved, it would add about $320 a year to the tax bill of the average Nantucket home assessed at $2.7 million with a residential exemption. The proposals include $16.2 million in general capital spending and $26.2 million in debt exclusion override spending. The general capital spending does also include a $4.3 million override, while the remaining $11.9 million would come from the town's surplus, ironically called free cash by the state, and the 2025 tax levy. So, yeah, there's a lot of numbers there. But the $26.2 million in debt exclusion spending also includes the purchase price of the former youth hostel in Surfside, estimated about $6 million that the town hopes to use for employee housing, particularly summer housing for lifeguards and other summer employees. Debt exclusions allow towns to raise one-time taxes for specific purposes, and they're allowed to be exempt from the state law known as Prop 2.5, which limits spending to 2.5% above the previous year's annual budget expenses. Debt exclusions do also require a two-thirds majority at town meeting and a majority vote at the ballot box. There's a few other items of note on this list as well, including $3 million to conduct a town employee housing feasibility study, $1.2 million in additional funding for the design, permitting, and engineering of a new public works facility, $2 million for transportation improvements on Newtown Road, and $2 million for debris removal, erosion control, and dune restoration in Tom Nevers. A number of storms in January exposed the bluff in Tom Nevers, and a lot of construction debris left over from the demolition of the former Navy base in that area.
You've got a nice rundown of all the different articles in the paper there so people can take a look at them. Town meeting, just remind us what the date is.
May 7th.
Okay. The Island Hospital, meanwhile, is expanding its urgent care facility. This comes as demand has really risen for these services.
It has. They're really ramping up access to its urgent access clinic, including more staff, more than doubling the building space, expanding the services, and they're now taking walk-ins as well. And the move comes as demand for urgent care has been challenging to keep up with, and appointments have been difficult to snag at the hospital. Primarily because of the way in which people look to receive health care these days is changing, not just on Nantucket, but nationwide. Hospital President Amy Lee said they really want to be able to walk into receive their medical care as opposed to making an appointment with, they say, a primary care physician. Urgent access in particular is for more minor injuries or illnesses like tick bites, rashes, coughs and colds, sore throats, eye infections, that kind of thing. They're also hoping to expand the care in the future to include laceration care and suturing. The clinic on Nantucket was created about 5 years ago when it was only open on the weekends and really very sort of minimally staffed. It's grown significantly since then, but this is the biggest jump by far. They're going to be located in a building next to the main hospital building on their Prospect Street campus, and they've actually also hired a doctor, Dr. Stephen Kohler, to serve as their first ever medical director, specifically in charge of urgent access. So they're putting a lot of attention and a lot of resources into expanding urgent care on the island.
And the new expanded facility is expected to be open by this summer?
By this summer, by Memorial Day, by the start of the summer.
Mm. That is Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks.
Thank you.
Momentum is gathering behind the state's effort to hold Steward Health Care accountable, including a push from the Attorney General this week. Steward operates hospitals throughout Massachusetts, including one on the South Coast. With Steward's finances in chaos, the state is pushing for better patient access. Morning Edition host Patrick Flannery spoke with our State House correspondent Katie Lannon about this story and more. Here's their conversation.
Hello there, Katie.
Hey, Patrick. Good morning.
Katie, I realize it's been a bit sleepy this week at the State House with school vacation in the mix, but there are some interesting bits to get to, including increased pressure on Steward Healthcare. This is the network that runs hospitals throughout the state. One is in Fall River. And it's been criticized by pretty much everybody of import, the governor and now the attorney general just the other day, for this network not being truthful about its expenses and its finances. What's going on?
A lot is going on, in short. The Healey administration is starting to have meetings now in different regions of the state to talk to local healthcare leaders and advocates about how to make sure Steward's patients can still access care, that their providers get paid, what will happen with medical students in those hospitals as the network and the state's healthcare system as a large navigates through the uncertainty about whether these facilities will close, whether they'll be transferred to new owners. We've seen calls really ramp up for some sort of legislative action from Attorney General Andrea Campbell, suggesting she'd like more authority over for-profit healthcare systems like Steward, the way she has with nonprofit healthcare systems. We've seen some top Democrats on Beacon Hill suggest looking at private equity in healthcare or the real estate deals where companies like Steward sell the land from under their hospitals to investment trusts. I did ask Health and Human Services Secretary Kate Walsh this week, the state's top healthcare official, what she thinks about going after private equity in healthcare. And she really warned against the idea of acting too hastily when the nation's healthcare system is so complicated, doing something that would put Massachusetts at odds with the rest of the country.
Let's stick with Attorney General Andrea Campbell, who had a very busy week. She weighed in on AI, artificial intelligence. Her advisory applies the state's consumer protection laws to AI technology. So for argument's sake, deep fakes, does this mean her office prosecutes those cases, and how do they identify them?
It could mean that. What the AG is doing here is saying that if you are scammed or defrauded by AI, if, you know, a deep fake or voice cloning tricks you into sharing personal information with what you thought was maybe a trusted business partner, then a scam by technology is the same as if it's a person who scammed you. She's also wants to make clear that anti-discrimination laws and some other state laws apply to technology. So you can't falsely advertise AI. And, you know, I think her office will be looking for these cases the same way they prosecute anything else. She's been encouraging folks to reach out to her team if they do feel they've run into an AI scam. scam or other bad behavior there.
Those fake robocalls come to mind, the one specifically voicing Joe Biden, which was not in fact Joe Biden. Black women are three times likelier than white women, Katie, to die during a pregnancy. That's according to the CDC. And this is an important fact within the context of something Governor Healey addressed this week, and that is investing money in the life sciences. What does she hope to address when it comes specifically to maternal health?
Yeah, the governor this week announced around $3 million in grant money looking at for projects researching things like less invasive screenings for cervical cancer, new efforts to treat and diagnose endometriosis, technologies to help better understand pregnancy risks. And, you know, she's tying this into a push she wants to make to reauthorize the state's big investment in life sciences with another $1 billion over 10 years. Because the Healey administration sees the life sciences push as affecting all of healthcare and says continuing to cement Massachusetts as a leader in that space will help the state look at these areas like women's health that, as the governor says, have gone largely under-addressed to the degree that they need to be addressed for a long time throughout history. So she's at once looking to help address these inequities we see in maternal health care and other types of health care and make another push for her big economic development bill.
All right. Finally, Katie, I see on Twitter you shared an election year milestone, as you called it. It was the first ballot question advertisement of the election season. We're about, 6 months out from this. What did the ad focus on, and what are a couple of other potential ballot questions voters should know about?
Yeah, first ad to come across my screen was for a ballot question focused on gig economy drivers, and it's a question that would cement their status as independent contractors, not employees, and that's a question that's backed by some of those big companies like DoorDash, Lyft, Uber, Instacart, so you can expect a lot of money to be pouring into this campaign with unions on the other side. Certainly won't be the last ad that I see or any of us see. Like you say, there's several months to go, but I think we're going to see campaigns heat up too for other ballot questions like removing the use of MCAS tests as a graduation requirement, legalizing psychedelics, raising the minimum wage for tipped workers. And, you know, of course, as we've talked about before, the state auditor's push to open up the books of the state legislature.
November will be here tomorrow. Katie Lannon from the State House, as always, thanks for taking your time with us.
Thank you.
And that is CAI Morning Edition host Patrick Flannery speaking with our State House correspondent Katie Lannon. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. I'm Steve Junker. New Bedford is looking at some major infrastructure projects in the next few years, as several bridges in and around the city are slated to be repaired or rebuilt. Grace Ferguson of the New Bedford Light has all the details for us and joins us. Hi, Grace.
Hi, Steve.
There's one particular interchange that you really zero in on here, which itself includes five bridges, all of which need replacing. This is along I-195. Start by telling us about this. It's a familiar spot, I'm sure, for many folks.
Yeah, so this interchange is the I-195 Route 18 interchange, which if you've ever been on I-195, you're heading for downtown New Bedford. This is probably the interchange you went through. It has a few bridges that are considered structurally deficient, which means some of their components are in poor condition based on the state MassDOT criteria, and so it's time to replace it. So the state is gearing up to do that starting in spring of next year, and it'll run through fall of 2029, this big replacement project.
So these are kind of those big curving, almost like cloverleaf style off-ramps that we're calling the bridges that take you off I-195 and direct you onto to 18 there and head into New Bedford. You have some images from underneath the bridge of when they did some, you know, surveying here to decide that this has to happen. Talk about what's happened to these interchanges and what they look like right now.
Yeah, so these bridges date back to 1965, and in recent inspections, they found crumbling concrete, deteriorated steel, rusted pipes. There's some exposed reinforcing under the bridges, and I should reiterate, they're not dangerous to drive on, but they are definitely due for some repairs.
This sounds like such a traffic-inducing thing that's coming towards all of us here. What is the state planning for this? How long will it take to replace these, and what kinds of impacts are they looking at?
Yeah, so the project is going to run from spring 2025 to fall 2029, and each ramp during that period is going to be closed for about a year. The official detour that the state is planning right now is a 15-mile round trip to Mattapoisett and back. And the reason they have to do that, I know that sounds kind of the reason they have to do that is because they aren't allowed to reroute traffic onto local roads, and they also have to accommodate trucks, and trucks can't make U-turns very easily. So there is another interchange in Fairhaven, but that wasn't that full four-loop cloverleaf that would allow trucks to turn around. And so then the nearest interchange to that is in Mattapoisett. Now, they are going to keep other ramps in the New Bedford area open during that period. So people in New Bedford will probably be familiar with Coggeshall, Washburn, Penniman Street ramps. Those will still be open. They aren't going to deposit you directly onto Route 18, but they will get you closer to your destination than going all the way to Mattapoisett and back.
Not only the actual work, the structural work of replacing these bridges is being planned, but work around this whole area and how the way these bridges interact with the neighborhood is being looked at here. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, they are going to do some improvements in that area. They're going to put up some sound barriers in the neighborhood. Originally, they were actually going to put up these huge walls, which would kind of wall the neighborhood off from the interchange. But the city put in some feedback on that saying, no, wait, it's going to wall off the north end from downtown. So there will be some sound barriers. The other thing they're doing is they're going to plant some more trees and add some pedestrian walkways to make that area a little bit more walkable and pedestrian friendly.
There's some great, I don't know if this is drone footage that you guys got, but of just footage of these interchanges in action, and you can really kind of get a sense of how big this project is and how much traffic's moving across it.
Yeah, I mean, it is enormous, and this is a super vital interchange to New Bedford. I use this all the time, multiple times a week, and I'm sure most other people in New Bedford are very familiar with this area.
All right, so some traffic pain headed our way, but they're taking on a project that needs to get done. You also highlight in your article a number of other projects that are sort of on the horizon or being examined. One of them is the New Bedford-Fairhaven Bridge replacement. This is a swing bridge. It opens up. But talk about what they're looking at for replacing it.
Yeah, so right now it's a swing bridge. It opens up kind of like a door. The state announced earlier this year that their preferred design for the replacement is a vertical lift bridge, which I'll do my best to explain this over the radio, but I picture it kind of like a limbo bar. So the road stays parallel with the water, but it rises up and down. The city of New Bedford reached out to the state earlier this year with some concerns about that design choice, mostly because it would impose a height limit where there isn't a height limit right now. And they had some concerns about how that could affect the potential wind industry in the future. None of that work is currently happening in the Inner Harbor, but they said maybe it could in the future. And so they didn't want to put a limit if they didn't have to. So the city's communicating with the state right now over that potential design. The city also suggested possibly doing more like a traditional drawbridge, where it hinges upward.
But that's more involved, is what they've said. It would take longer and cost a lot more money.
Exactly. The great thing about the vertical lift bridge is that would only take a year to a year and a half to construct, and all the other bridge designs are more in the 3 to 5 year range for construction. But the city also said, well, you know, you're making trade-offs here, but if this bridge is going to be there for 100 years, maybe that 3 to 5 year span could be worth it.
And the last bridge was there for 125 years.
Yes.
It's Grace Ferguson.
Yeah,
we have to leave it there, Grace, but thank you so much. Grace Ferguson of the New Bedford Light, where you can read all about it. Thanks, Grace.
Thanks, Steve.
That is our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Eve Zukoff. We spoke with Unki Sanu of the Martha's Vineyard Times and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We heard from Ed Miller of the Provincetown Independent and Josh Balling of the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. CAI's Patrick Flannery spoke with our State House correspondent Katie Lannon and Grace Ferguson there from the New Bedford Light. Thanks to Dan Treidel for engineering the program. When they make the action movie of CAI, the superhero role is going to Dan. Thanks, Dan. Thank you for listening. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week.